Dr. Stan here at the Genesis Communication Network, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, let's see if William Grieg is here, and then you'll be listening to his views for the next hour. William, are you there?
Dr. Stan, I am here.
All right, fine. Well, of course,
delightful to be with you, as always.
William, of course, is formerly the senior editor of the New American magazine, and, of course, now he's writing blogs and books and doing a lot of radio programs, and we always look forward to having him with us. In fact, I saw one of his articles posted on World Affairs Brief today, so I'm going to let William pick up the story. And what do you think the most important issues are that we're going to be talking about today?
It's difficult to say which of the many disasters we could confer the title of most important issue on right now, because so many things are imploding all at once. But I do think it's worth noting that once again we seem to be dealing with our perennial quasi-crisis with North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. There was this atomic test that purportedly took place a few days ago, and they just test-fired another short-range missile within the last 24 hours. And this is one of those things that's kept sort of on a back burner, to low boil, by the architects of our misfortune. For the last half century or more, North Korea has been an abiding sore, a festering wound, and it's something that has been very carefully nurtured in that condition by the people who benefit from a perpetual state of crisis. I remember 15 years ago, back in 1994, almost exactly 15 years ago, there was a huge outcry over the prospect of North Korea going nuclear, and within about 2 days of the first alarm being sounded by the mainstream press, you have this amazing spectacle of all these people who are attached to the same constellation of establishment groups, the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, all these groups that are in charge of defining the ruling consensus for the rest of us, go before the television cameras and talk in very sober and stern terms about the possibility of actually the Clinton administration actually staging a preemptive nuclear strike on North Korea. I remember a Crossfire segment in particular in which you had Zbigniew Brzezinski, and if memory serves, another person, another august luminary of the Trilateral Commission, speaking about the prospect of an actual nuclear strike on North Korea of a preemptive fashion. And I found myself astonished that people would be saying such things for public consumption, because, of course, the pious assurances we always receive are that the United States would never resort to the first use of nuclear weapons, although it's never repudiated the first use of the nuclear weapons, and the only country ever to use the atomic bomb remains the United States. But, of course, North Korea is as close to a museum-quality specimen of outright totalitarian communism as we've ever seen. It's been nurtured and cultivated in that role, very carefully maintained in that role through a combination of really stupid geostrategic policy. Stupid, I put stupid in scare quotes because, of course, it's not so much stupid as duplicitous. And on the other hand, some really bizarre diplomacy by the same source. The same people who are creating this standoff, this hair-trigger standoff over the DMZ at the 38th parallel there in Korea, are the same people who have been supplying the dynastic Kim regime with everything it needs to survive in terms of material and financial support. And one of the things that has happened as well is that by maintaining a huge allotment of troops and military material there at the DMZ, we're helping really to reinforce the Kim regime's fundamental conceit that they are holding the decadent West at bay. And those people in that pathless slave country who support the government do so because they have been successfully programmed to believe that absent these onerous impositions by the government and the whatever magical influence their dear leader exercises, they would be overrun by the decadent West. And so it's really quite an interesting multiple-layer, mutually reinforcing role-playing game that we have going on over there. Because really, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, before him, served sort of the same purpose for Western consumption. These so-called rogue dictators are always being shaken in our face now as a justification for our interventionist foreign policy, this hugely overgrown so-called defense establishment that does everything but defend our country, as we found out on September 11th, and our persistent entanglement in the affairs of other countries, such as South Korea, who are perfectly capable of taking care of their own defense if they were permitted to. The same thing, of course, is true of Japan. And now we find ourselves once again, as we always do with metronomic regularity, confronting the prospect of another imminent crisis on the Korean Peninsula. And one element of this subject that very rarely gets discussed is the role of the United Nations in the whole affair. Go way back to the beginning of the crisis back in 1950. This was really the first time that American troops had ever fought under the flag of another sovereign, the sovereign in this case being the putative world community represented by the United Nations, as that organization grandly styles itself. The American troops fought under that sickly pale blue banner, and they were buried beneath that sickly pale blue banner. And if you are really interested in a really suitable definition of the word obscenity, I think that fact qualifies. They were forced to die for a tie after MacArthur had the war won. The United Nations essentially facilitated the delivery of half of Korea into the hands of the communists.
Well, you know, I think one of the big problems, William, is that people really don't understand that war. Most people are too young to remember it.
That's true.
One of the best sources of information is MacArthur's reminiscences.
Indeed.
And there he will tell you that he was not allowed to bomb the electric plants, not those up along the Yalu River, but those major electric plants in North Korea. Why would you try to defeat the enemy by just wiping out their electricity? And then, of course, he wasn't even allowed to bomb the major major supply depots of the enemy in North Vietnam. Now, why would you want to fight a war, and you gave the enemy their supply depots to have plenty of supplies so they could kill your soldiers?
Exactly.
That really makes any sense. And if you read that book, and I think it's one of the most important books in my library, General MacArthur quotes the communist general who commanded the troops who came across the Yalu as saying, "I would never have risked my troops and my reputation and brought them across the Yalu if I had not been guaranteed that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from taking retaliatory action on my supply lines." Well, MacArthur didn't know that.
No.
But there was a secret agreement between the people in our government and the people in the Chinese Communist government that we would never win that war. It was another example of a no-win war. Most people don't understand that we put the 7th Fleet in between Formosa or Taiwan and the mainland as much to, mm-hmm. To keep the Taiwanese from attacking the mainland as to keep the Chinese communists from attacking Taiwan. And that way the Chinese communists could take two of their massive armies and move them up into Manchuria to come down to kill our boys. Nothing as it appears to be.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Go right ahead.
And of course, the highest-ranking military official at the United Nations and their military staff was a general in the Soviet Army, and he was, of course, in communication with his Chinese counterpart, and the Chinese were in communication with their surrogates in North Korea. And everything that the United States did, that General MacArthur did, rather, as part of this UN-directed effort by way of tactics and strategy, had to be vetted with this Soviet general who relayed that information directly to the people MacArthur was fighting. That's something else that MacArthur wasn't aware of. It's really surprising that MacArthur would have been as naive as he was, but a lot of people were beguiled by what was going on after World War II. There was this assumption that the United Nations would prevent another globe-straddling catastrophe, another worldwide conflagration of the sort that erupted with World War II, with tens of millions of people dying in the horrible situations where entire populations were being destroyed. The assumption was that through this magical doctrine of collective security, we'd be able to amputate